Have you done a podcast before? I was trying to find one.
So I have.
Here, choke up on the mic. Otherwise, yeah.
It's been a while. I've done a few maybe 4 years ago, and podcasts were just becoming a thing. So I'm excited to be here.
Dude, this is unbelievable. I was trying to find one. I was like, I found there's a video of you online doing an interview.
Yeah. So I actually helped start another podcast several years ago and have some podcast clients. So it's fun to be on the other side.
When you have a podcast client, was that like you've done deals for them with like podcast networks or things like that?
Yeah. So, I had various distributors of podcasts like Cumulus and things like that. I've done some of those.
Yeah. It's good stuff. I didn't realize this because you sent me your bio and I was looking over it, and sometimes it's hard to know like what lawyers are up to because you know there's a lot of confidentiality things, but I didn't realize that this deal you did with Warren Zeiders was like one of the largest deals in country music for a new artist.
It's been insane. You know, I think that, as you know, the TikTok whole short form video content, social media stuff has gone nuts, and so he was really found the sweet spot where he was creating a ton of content and building so much leverage for himself. He ran off a clip of like something like 90 days where he was streamed 1 million streams a day, which is just bonkers numbers. And so it was perfect storm, and really on the heels. He's label mates with Zach Bryan, who also has significant success leveraging the platform, and so it was a really cool thing, and it came together. His manager, Charlie Salvatore, and I just kind of worked that and saw the process out. And yeah, I think it, you know, there's no way to verify what the biggest deal ever was because of client confidentiality, but I've never heard of a deal for an intro artist in Nashville that size. So
whose deal was done first? Bailey's Warren Zeiders deal or Zach Bryan's deal?
Yeah, Zach has been with Warner Records for two or three years before Warren's deal. So
do you think that they were seeing like great success with an artist kind of in the country space, and that was appealing about
the
Warren?
The bigger conversation too is the interesting dynamics between Nashville country labels and then the interjection and influence now of at labels outside of Nashville feeling like they can get in the country game, and finding out what that, sometimes it's even within their own company system, like Warner Records. Obviously we have a powerful Warner Nashville shop here, and so those dynamics of working, finding collaboration points and working things. But I would say that outside of Nashville, whenever they get a country artist right now, for better or worse, they just kind of let them do whatever they want. And it's a lot of times unconventional. They'll put out tons of releases, put out like cover recordings, re-record and re-release things two or three times in different versions. And you see success with Warren, but also Zach Bryan and Bailey and some of the other guys that are coming. Just
even like Megan Maroney, her deals with Columbia in New York, and then they did the deal with Sony. Which I think it's like a trend that's happening right now. It's like
is
that because when you go out, you get bigger advances? Like, why are people?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know this to be true, but my sense is that when the leverage gets to a certain point, it's all in the numbers, right? With streaming, so once you, it's really hard. For example, if you have really high streaming numbers and you're putting it out through TuneCore, then you're getting a check for six figures monthly if you're streaming at a high clip. Well, that's really hard to compete with for a Nashville record label, even a major, because a baby deal, what I would call it, would be probably close to what someone that is streaming high numbers are getting paid monthly. So why would
they don't need
the
advance and then they're gonna
And so big picture, the pop space is built for that infrastructure in New York and LA. So now that's why you see a lot of these country artists coming backdooring their way into Nashville deals through bigger imprints, because they don't flinch at a larger advance because they have the data. They're really very data driven outside of Nashville, less on, you know, gut instinct, A&R, more on what they get, they pull the reports kind of like Moneyball, you know, and look at the numbers and then kind of say, how much is this going to make over X amount of time? This is what we can afford. And so they kind of bootstrap it. That's my impression anyway.
Right. So when you did the Warren Zeiders deal, mm-hmm. I guess, did you have a relationship with Charlie, or how'd you get in originally with him?
Yeah, I met Charlie through some other artists a little bit before. He's really super like motivated entrepreneur, going back several years, been in town grinding. A lot of the guys kind of around my age, I'm around 40, and we've all been here for over a decade, just kind of cutting our teeth.
You put your 10 years into the 10-year town.
We did. So I mean, like they say, it's a 10-year town for songwriters and artists. It's no different for industry professionals. You know, I came here in 2011, and just in 2022 was made Billboard top music attorney list. So that was exactly right on the button. 10 years.
Oh no way! Wait, you? Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah.
So, okay, wait, so you come here, so you meet Charlie, and then what I'm curious about is, like, you do this deal with Warner.
Yes.
For Warren Zeiders, or just any deal, like, originally, how does it start out? Does the label send you an original, you know, a first draft of what a deal is, and then do you, go and start redlining and say, no, or was the first deal, like, pretty close to what it looked like? Maybe not even for Warren specifically, if you can't talk about it, just, like, in general, is it... How's the flow typically work?
So, you know, just to back up a little bit, you really have now, you know, about five entrances into becoming an artist in not just country, but any genre. So obviously it starts first with the music. Obviously you have to be talented, have to have good music, but the five kind of entrances are you're performing phenomenally live and drawing big numbers. That's one. The second is social media presence. That can be TikTok, Instagram, whatever. The third is kind of the, what I call the buddy system, where you're super talented already, but you have some type of in. Like you see this with Cole Swindell and Luke Bryan. You know, he was on the road with him and kind of you leverage that connection. Then you have a more reality show type of entrance, which allows you to bypass. And then you have the Nashville, also common in LA producer world, like you come up as a songwriter and have some hits as a songwriter first, and that gives you the credibility to shift over to artist. So those are the five. So if you collect more than one of those five, that only increases your leverage. So like for Warren, you know, he was on the social media following path and very successful at leveraging his TikTok fame into building a bridge to streaming platforms. But if you can be TikTok famous but not put any music out, and it doesn't work. You have to be able to build the bridge. And so he was very successful in doing that. Whereas another artist like Luke Combs, when 1,200 people were showing up for a 200-person venue in Asheville, North Carolina,
that was enough.
Yeah, it gets people's attention. You know, he followed the live performance route there. And so in contract negotiation, it's all about leverage. It's a leverage game. So we try to look at what the strengths are of the artist, or I'll also work with songwriters and producers, and leverage is similar across the board, but look at what your strengths are, look at what you have going on so far, and leverage that into a deal. Sometimes in the case of Warren, you know, you create enough leverage, they're reaching out to you, but that's not always the case. Sometimes we'll self-identify just like any other A&R person would, like a really talented artist, songwriter, producer, and try to make some connections for them, make some introductions. I'd say maybe 20 years ago in Los Angeles, all the attorneys were the deal makers. And that's kind of what my model is. It's a little bit different than the traditional Nashville model, but I love doing deals. It's kind of my bread and butter. And people ask me what my hobbies are, and I'm like, outside of, you know, my kids and family, I just love doing deals. So
that's when you go into a deal with an artist like Warren, how much of that deal do you have a sense going in, you know, knowing where the artist is in terms of social numbers and the leverage that you're bringing to the table? How much of a sense do you feel like you sort of know what the deal is going to look like and it's black and white, versus how much do you feel like this is a blank slate and let's be creative about this deal and figure it out? Is it more black and white, or do you feel like you're able to get in the weeds and be creative about how the deal can actually be structured?
I mean, Warren specifically was an anomaly. It kind of had a life of its own in the negotiation process because so many people were coming to the table. But especially songwriter producers, depending on where they are in their career, I have a general sense of what's going on in the market here and in LA, and can kind of peg where I want it to land. And then we will shop out, and depending on if this is their first deal, or if this is, you know, their second deal or third deal, kind of know what their market value is and able to land it within certain parameters. But no one deals the same. You know, and it also depends on what the personal needs of the client are, because you know, have some songwriter and producers that don't have a very high cost of living, so they would rather have more ownership in their copyrights in the long term, so they'll take less money as an advance and in exchange for greater ownership, versus, you know, others may have families or a big mortgage or something they're trying to pay off and will take more money up front and have less ownership on the back end, if that makes sense.
Right. How aggressive can you be with a major when you're negotiating a deal with an artist? Is most of the negotiation done redlining the contract and back and forth, or are you often on the phone with their legal and going back and forth, and does it get aggressive or does it stay pretty cordial?
Yeah, it's pretty cordial, I would say, with business affairs of any of the majors or any deals as far as publishing company, if they have in-house business affairs, because obviously I'm not incentivized to tick anybody off and then have to come back to the table on another deal and do that. But I will say that it really is a leverage thing depending on how many offers are at the table, what the artist preferences are. But it's a very competitive arena, the music lawyering, I would say. And so I'm super competitive myself, and there are a lot of times where we have very difficult negotiations, and that's one of what I think is really enjoyable for me. Maybe not for all personalities, but
yeah,
I love it.
Artist rights is definitely a big topic right now, just in music media. Have you seen in the 10 years that you've been in Nashville, have the deals, does it feel like they've started to become more in the favor of the artist, or have they changed in 10 years to be better for the artist, or do you feel like in reality the deals are pretty much the same that they were 10 years ago?
Well, I think these had kind of a bell curve. The deals maybe 15, 20 years ago were more artist friendly, a lot of money flowing into the pockets of artists. That
you think they were more friendly
20 years ago?
20 years ago. Okay, yeah.
And then we went through a period where the kind of invention or inclusion of 360 rights kind of came,
right.
And now I think we're on the backside of that coming down. The deals are becoming a little more friendly again. I think it's because of the short form video exploitation and artists really being able to build a little of that leverage that I'm talking about on the front end before walking in. Because if a label finds someone fresh, like no exposure, no anything, they believe in them, they see talent, but there's nothing going on, then they can kind of, they have the leverage, right? They can give them a worse deal on worse terms that's more favorable to the label, not to the artist, which, you know, if Universal or Sony shows up at your door and you post it on TikTok like 4 times and you don't have any songs out and say they're going to give you a record deal, you're going to take your record deal, you know?
Yeah.
But, you know, because there's so much access, so much more access now, I think artists are able to create that leverage on the front end, and they can do the math once they see what they're making and figure out whether something's good or not.
Do you see, because I can point to like a handful of artists in town that have massive, massive social followings. Some of them are even touring and selling lots of tickets, and they say that they can't find the right record deal, which I'm inclined to believe, but you see what these deals actually are. I'm sure you can think of a couple of these people as well who are touring, playing theaters, playing clubs, putting out music completely independent, doing it on their own, maybe with like a distributor. You know what the deals are because you look at so many of them. Do you feel like that's right, that the right deal hasn't found them yet, or it's not out there? Or do you think that at that, you know, if you're in that position, are you choosing to not sign a record deal and saying, hey, we're going to go this alone? Or is it sometimes hard to find the right deal for the right artist in that case?
I think it's a combination of just because they're not signed to a record deal, independent doesn't always mean you don't have a team.
Right.
And so you may also have a manager or an agent that's bringing stuff to you. And so I think it's a matter of if, like in an instance of a high streaming artist, they're making a decent amount of money just through their TuneCore or CD Baby or small distribution partner. So they're less willing to give up. You know, when you're poor, you'll do what you can to get the money, the paycheck. But if you're already have money, you know, the first step in making it as a musician in the industry is supporting yourself, having a living wage. And if you have that plus a little sum, then you're less worried about going into a long-term arrangement with a company because you might lose rights, might lose control of the creative product and things like that. So I think finding the right deal is an easy way to say, I'm already making more money probably than they would offer me, so they're either going to have to raise their price or
you know,
leave me with some of my rights or give me a compelling reason, marketing plan, access to radio, things like that, that I can't already achieve on my own. Because that's really the purpose of a major now is there nobody really has access to country radio in the country space or even pop radio in the pop space because it costs millions of dollars to take an artist to radio. So that's if you want to be on radio, you're going to have to sign with a label pretty much.
Right. Okay, before we move on from this, any good negotiation tactics that you use in your life that maybe anyone can use in their life? Do you have any like go-tos or any strategies or any things that you've just read in books that are just like, you know, school?
Yeah.
That's what you do to negotiate.
I mean, I try really hard to not negotiate against myself.
How do you not do that? Or what does that mean?
And so whether it's I kind of refuse or avoid throwing out my deal points in advance when I meet with the client and assess their situation, know what kind of leverage they have, know what the market is. We'll set a range behind the scenes of kind of, I think this is where it'll land, but we'll collect first offers and let a lot of labels will even ask the writer or the publisher or the producer or the artist, like, what are you looking for? And I always coach them to say, I'm looking for a place that gets me creatively, that has a good culture.
Don't say a number, basically.
Exactly.
Do you think they're asking that because they want them to make the first move?
Oh, yeah.
100%, right?
100%.
Because they want them to say, I'm looking for $30,000 or whatever the number is.
I really need $30,000 to pay my bills, and that's what I'm most concerned about right now. Don't ever say that.
Right. Yeah.
Leave that to your attorneys or reps. But that's kind of, you know, first things first, never negotiate against yourself, even when you're getting comments back that are general from the other side, like, we can't do this number, then I would never come back and say, well, what about this number? I would just say, well, tell me what you're proposing.
You know. What's the thing? Because I was negotiating a deal for something, big sponsorship opportunity.
Yeah.
And I said to them, what was your budget? And they said to me, well, what are you looking for? And I said, well, when you give me your budget, I can put the best package together for you. And they said, well, we'd love to see the package. Like, they knew, you know, we were both on the same page about what we were doing.
Yeah.
And then eventually I gave in. I gave a high number to what I thought because I was like, this isn't going anywhere. So I felt like I had to give a high number to keep the conversation moving. They came back and we sort of met in the middle. But sometimes it's really hard because, like, I feel like people both know this game if you're dealing with, you know, smart negotiators. So, like, where do you go from there? At some point, someone has to give in, right?
My second step in that negotiation is to go with the humor route and just be like, whatever you're thinking, double it. No.
but do you say that? Is that a real line that you
say?
I will say it.
But, I mean, usually, again, with market experience, this is why it's really important for artists, songwriter, producers to have an attorney that is doing this day in and day out because I can ballpark what it looks like, and I would just revert to, well, these are similar deals that I've done lately, and this is where it landed. And probably shoot a little over that, because at the end of the day, we're all playing in the same pool here, whether it's here or LA, and so people know kind of what people get. But the important thing is, for me personally, I only want to take as much money in an advance to make sure not just the artist or songwriter is comfortable financially, but maybe a little bit more than that so that they're being able to get the few nice things that they want if they're in a leveraged position. But the biggest thing is the rights, grabbing as most of the rights on the back end as possible. If you create some leverage in the middle of your deal right now, I'm doing renegotiating deals that are in the middle of the term, not at a renegotiation point, but the writers or artists have leverage because of sudden popularity, and so we're already renegotiating their deals to try to capitalize on that leverage moving forward.
What do you bring to the table when you do that? Because that's something that always makes my head spin is like, yes, you might have leverage, but you're in a deal. So what do you negotiate? You try to give something else to get something else? Like, how's that
right,
work?
Right. We would just give an example of a songwriter that all of a sudden, you know, has several number ones, but they're still in their first deal, meaning it's very terms that aren't as favorable to them. We would just say, hey, we're going to give you a couple more years, and, you know, in exchange, we hope that you'll give us more ownership in the back catalog because we all want to win together. It's a good relationship. Let's just keep it going for the long run. situation like that. And most of the times the publishers or the label will see that value and, you know, really recognize that as a long-term investment opportunity on both sides.
Among the publishers in town in LA, definitely you have majors, you have major indies. Without giving any names, are there some that you get super excited to negotiate with because you know it's going to be a good process? And are there others where you go, oh God, this is going to be tough. I know that person. That's a hard ass. Or across the major players, do you think people are overall pretty fair?
So I think that companies that have in-house business affairs folks, like in-house legal, always easier to negotiate with than companies that typically the smaller companies like independent publishers or independent record labels will have like a outside general counsel, which is like a someone at a law firm. And I'm on the other side representing independent publishers, independent labels as well. That's more difficult conversation because we're usually the ones being strategic and aggressive on our side. So when you pit two aggressive attorneys with each other, you know, negotiating, who have seen a wide variety of deals from multiple companies, it can be a very difficult to get the deal done. When you're working with like someone that is an in-house counsel in the majors, they only see the deals that their company does. They're not worried about
right.
what Sony or Universal, you know, they're not worried about the other companies. They're just, these are the types of deals we do. This is our form. These are the points that are negotiable. These are not, you know. And so really on those, we're only talking about money and ownership. That's really the only variables. But when you're dealing with another independent outside counsel that's representing an independent company, you're not just talking about the material money and points. You're talking about really a lot of times the structure of the deal, like this provision is written incorrectly, you know, because I'm experiencing this and you guys need to rewrite this whole section and you left out words here. It's more in depth, like kind of intellectual attorney arguing involved versus
right.
You know, dealing with internal business affairs.
So whenever you're like, oh, that company has internal business affairs, you take a breath or whatever.
No
you
doubt.
Say this is
no
going
doubt.
Into it, this is probably gonna be a little bit more, you know, I don't know, an easier experience.
Yeah, for sure. And again, it's super competitive, and if you're an attorney that's an outside counsel, kind of independent, like you're in a different law firm, then you also have artist, songwriter, producer clients in addition to your company clients. And so we're all doing deals with each other and we're highly motivated and highly competitive and, you know, going after the same type of clients. So it's a very interesting. It's not for the weak.
It's not for the faint of heart.
It is not.
This is so in your bio, I mean, one of the things that was like super impressive last year, it says you did $20 million
yeah.
worth of deals, which, you know, seems like a very impressive number. As a lawyer, as you're tracking your career, is that a metric that really shows success, or is that, even though it's impressive, is it a little superficial? Like, is there something else that you look to, like the types of deals or the quality
sure.
deals or the types of clients that you work with? Or is that something that you look at and you go, that really is a statement of success that I'm holding myself to, and next year I want to do $30 million or whatever it is?
Yeah, so I mean, I think that every year is different in how it plays out for the work that we do, but for me, last year was really interesting. You know, that wasn't just a one-off deal for $18 million and then random other stuff.
Yeah.
You know, we really worked hard to put, I mean, my heart, coming from the management space a long time ago, my heart is in the creative development and the putting clients in the right position to succeed. So a lot of that $20 million was small deals that added up, you know, game-changing in the personal context for a lot of developing artists, songwriters, producers, having their first deals, having, you know, after their first or second deals, finally signing with a major label. So that $20 million represents the success story of probably over 100 clients last year. You know, I think there are some opportunities for bigger deals. I had the honor of doing some more acclaimed producers and songwriters catalog deals yet last year as well, and that's really interesting process. Less about the money, but just knowing that you're playing a part when you look at the Schedule A of all the songs and their songs that you kind of grew up on.
That's yeah, right.
Just so cool to be like, you know, you have an impact in the chain of title of this piece of intellectual property that you like grew up listening to, which is just so cool to me.
Yeah, Absolutely. And then recently you were just brought on board with Sync Music Group.
Yes.
To do their, well, I guess their country, they're getting into the country acquisition space. So they go, okay, we need an expert who knows the space really well. And then do they reach out to you or how's that relationship coming together?
Yeah, so a lot of clients come to me through mutual referral after being here over 10 years and doing deals with different folks. And so a business affairs or a business management company that I've done some accounting work with recommended me to them. And they're a very interesting company. A couple of their executives were named or nominated on Billboard's Executive of the Year list this year. And they're really motivated and forward thinking about getting into the country space after being in a lot of the Latin space and hip hop space for several years. But it's exciting. They, you know, deals come through various channels, and sometimes they were approached to be a funder or a purchaser of certain assets here, and other times, you know, folks from Nashville take stuff and they'll fund it that way. Sometimes as attorneys, we shop stuff around too. So it's going to be a good relationship. They've done a couple of ventures with another company, Boom Music Publishing, here in town, run by a couple of really good, smart entrepreneurs. So we're excited about that.
Do you do anything with you? I mean, you talk a lot about New York and LA. Are any deals happening? I'm sorry, LA and Nashville. Are any deals happening out of New York, or do you not really see any deals happening out of New York?
Yeah, New York is less active, I would say. Whenever I was first practicing, I would go to New York as much as I would go to LA. That just my deal flow personally, and just my general senses. New York is a little bit less active in the music scene currently. But everything kind of ebbs and flows, you know. You're still big three are New York, Nashville, and LA submarkets, like now Miami, Austin, Seattle, Chicago. Those are kind of the four music markets that below the big three. But for my personal book, I'm spending about a third of my book is in LA. So I do quite a bit of business out there.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah.
When you talk about, you have, handful of clients, like three clients that you do management consulting for, all yes. signed to major labels. Is that the kind of thing where they go, hey, Christian, like, we need you in this position. They come after you and you go, okay, let's figure out this works. Or do you go after them? Do you say, hey, like, I did the deal for you, but I really think I could help you in these areas? Like how does someone go from a client to, like, a management consulting client?
So typically I don't represent clients in the creative space in the management capacity if they're my legal client. What happened in this instance with a couple of them is that I represent the management company, and because I have experience in management prior to practicing law, one company in particular, Truth Management, owned by Missy Gallimore, who's legendary A&R guru in town, she opened her management company, signed four acts. Within 18 months, all four were signed to major labels, and it was kind of like an all-hands-on-deck situation. Like, we have four major label acts, and we just opened this company. Who all can help? It's kind of all-hands-on-deck. And so,
yeah, you were deputized.
I came into that capacity and started doing some management stuff for her acts. But outside of that, in the creative space, I always say more of a creative brand attorney approach, so any value adds that I can give to my clients, I'm not above doing anything. I've carried road gear. I've gone out on the road and, you know, did TM stuff.
Who are you going out with? You'll go out and TM a client?
TM a client.
And do you charge your lawyerly hourly rate? Because that probably gets expensive. You're spending days on the road with them.
All included. All included.
No, all included. This is the guy you want to represent you. And you'll go out and, like, you'll shop deals or, like, so, like, if someone gets a deal and they'll come to you and you'll say, like, hey, I've got a deal from X publishing company. Like, will you say, like, hey, like, this is great, super exciting, like, let's shop it around. They're like, don't sign that deal right away. Let's see. Yeah. Is that how it works?
Well, I don't like to, I love shopping for deals. What I'll typically do is create, like, a pitch deck for a client and shop it out to folks that I think would be good, a good partner. I don't overshop stuff. I'm very particular about my network and connections, and I try to not just give people a bunch of junk mail spam pitches. If I'm pitching something to you and you're an executive, I think that it's genuinely think that my client would be a good fit with you. And so, for example, we'll, you know, I have a couple of clients that are unsigned songwriters right now and have some traction on upcoming artist records. And so I'll put together kind of like a brief rundown and send it to my connections at different publishing companies that I think might be a good fit for this individual. Once we have kind of a bona fide offer, or if a publisher come to the table first and it wasn't something that I pitched out, I won't usually take that offer and just like shop it around and be like, hey, this publisher gave me this. What else can we get? You know, I think there's a lot of trust when music industry executives bring stuff to you for your client, and usually would try to get the best deal for the client, you know, with that publisher. But if I'm pitching out, then I'll pitch it to as many folks as possible.
Right.
There are other styles of practicing, of course, this type of law, and it's pretty niche, so everybody has their own flow.
So some people will go shop out, and you think that's bad character to get a deal and be like, let's just milk this around. Let's see, like, because that seems to me like if I got a publishing deal, I would love to do that, because A, you're in the driver's seat a little bit, and B, it's like, why not shop it around and see what the best deal is? But that's not really the best thing to do, right?
Well, I think that as an attorney, we have a reputation to uphold as to, you know, those business affairs contacts and relationships that are valuable in the long term. And so it's not, we would never do anything to the detriment of the client, but there's kind of a tiered system, and it's not illegal, it's not unethical, but it is the third one, which is just kind of uncool. It's not cool, and I try to stay out of that not cool when I'm on the pitch as much as possible. Now, I'm always also brutally honest with BA folks. If I do plan to shop it around, it won't be in secret. You know, if the offer is not, if it's not a good fit, or if it's not the terms that we were anticipating, I'll just point blank be like, we're really hoping to land this between here, or there seems to be some mutual interest between this client and this other company. We're just going to let that play out. And if you have thoughts on that, I'm really big proponent of a joint venture situation, meaning two companies, especially in the publishing world, coming together to do one deal.
So that would be like an independent with pretty much always a major, or is it worth doing a JV with a non-major or major?
Sometimes there's two independents, but my favorite is to do JVs with an independent and a major, because you get kind of the best of both worlds. You get the service and attention of an independent, but the backbone of a major, and it's just a really, I've had several deals like that, and I will even put together deals like that. There's a few right now that, you know, we're getting independent offers from majors and independents. I'm like, why don't we just like take a little bit off of what the writer was going to get and bring in two of you guys to do this deal together, so that everyone can win, you know, and get to success faster.
Right. Okay, wait, so going back a little bit. So when you originally started in management, when you were a manager, did you have your law degree, or were you a manager and then you got your law degree?
I did have my law degree. I kind of came to Nashville. My wife says when we were 17, I said, I can't decide if I'm going to work in the music industry or be an attorney. So I kind of came to Nashville with that same mentality, and ran across a few artists that didn't have managers and had always wanted to do it, like fresh off the bus in Nashville. And so lucked into doing some stuff, and so I had my law degree and kind of had launched my own solo practice and my management company at the same time.
And then when did you go to law school? 10 years ago, give or take?
Yeah, it was, 2009. So.
Wait, so you said how old you were. So you were what, in your like mid to late 20s when you went to law school? And then what were you doing before that, basically? Were you just trying to make it in the music industry and like graduate college and then?
Doing college and doing... you know, I have two master's degrees that I did before law school, so I was a professional student there for a minute.
Right. Yeah. Well, the thing is, like, I've always considered, I don't think I would ever do it, but I've thought about, like, would I ever go to law school? I don't think I would want to become a lawyer, but I do think I would be interested in law school. Like, I think law school would be interesting, but I don't think I would want to become a lawyer. But, what do you feel like you got something out of, like, if you had gone the management route and you ended up not taking the bar, maybe you took the bar, but you didn't become a lawyer, was it still valuable to get that education? Did it change the way you thought about the world or what, you know, whatever?
I do think that I also have my MBA, which I did before law school. And from a practical basis, that was the better education process that I utilize on a day-to-day basis in the entertainment industry, just from a full spectrum of knowledge and how a lot of things work, you know, whether it comes to accounting, marketing, management, all of those things. The law degree is more niche, obviously, and it's what I make my living at now. But for me, it, as far as the music industry, it's really a door opener more so than a practical tool for what I'm doing with it. But when you work in the music industry and you are a music attorney, that kind of puts you, it opens doors that a normal person just without that education wouldn't be able to enter. People will listen. It's just a legitimacy thing, I believe.
Right. When you went to law school, was there any doubt about, like, I mean, I feel like because you just so few people actually complete law school and it's so hard, whatever. Like, was there any doubt in whether you could do it, or were you set that you were like, I'm going to law school 100%, I'm going to do this, this is my thing? Or was a part of you like sort of questioning whether you had the ability to follow through and do it?
I've never been personally the type to question, you know, I always think of things and inevitabilities, so it was not really a whether or not something was going to happen. That's kind of always been my mentality, and I try to embrace that and teach clients that as well. It's kind of manifest your own success. I'm really big on really just motivation and culture and working hard, and so that's just kind of always been my mentality. So less about it was harder getting a foothold in Nashville than law school. You know, it was more difficult than going to law school and passing the bar, because once you do that, that's like adrenaline rush of several years worth of work. And then you come here and I start sending out emails like, hey, I'm, so-and-so, I just moved to Nashville, I'm interested in becoming an entertainment attorney. And it's like radio silence, you know, because it is such a competitive space. And, you know, the music law space is one of the sexier categories of law that you can practice because it's fun.
Yeah, it's definitely competitive because everything in Nashville entertainment is competitive. But I feel like if you go out and you hang around like younger people who just moved to town, it's like number one thing you hear is like, oh, I want to go work at Red Light, or I want to be a songwriter or an artist. I don't think I've ever met someone who's like, I want to be a lawyer, who's not already a lawyer. So yeah. Like, is it competitive? Like, if in that scene, were you seeing tons of other young lawyers that moved town that wanted to be lawyers?
I get about one email a day right now from
someone,
law students that want to be entertainment attorneys.
Yeah. And what do you, how, cause you, when you, someone put us in touch when we first met, yes, when I first moved town, and you met with me like a couple days later, we were having coffee, yeah, like around the corner from here. So like who will you meet with any of these people, or you really need a classic, like warm intro in order to meet with someone?
No, I mean, I think that I operate a little differently than most attorneys, really because of my experience when I moved here and all of those unanswered emails, or even emails from what are now prominent attorneys, like, it's competitive business, I don't have time to meet with you, best of luck. Like, that's even worse than
But don't you think, because I used to be so pissed off when I would email people and they wouldn't meet with me, I'd be like, come on, you're that busy. And now I get emails too from kids, I'm like, who am I? Like, I can't imagine what you're getting, but who am I? I get emails from college students probably also once a day, every other day, like without exaggeration. And I turn down most of them. I'll look at their resume, I'll check their LinkedIn. Mm-hmm. And like, typically, if there's not something there that really connects to me or whatever, I'm like, email someone else, or like, you're just emailing the Rolodex. Like there wasn't a connection here for us to meet. If someone emails me and they're like, hey, like, I want to work in media, I'm a journalism major, like, you know, whatever. Yeah. I get those emails all the time. I'm like, hey, like, I'll hop on a call or let me or whatever. But I get emails like, I'm a songwriter and like, I'd love to meet. And if it's a bad, I don't know, sometimes I will, but oftentimes I really don't. Yeah. Which maybe I should. I don't know.
Well, it's interesting. It's a time equity thing, you know, and your time's valuable. So I understand that a lot of people don't do it. For me, I just find value in mentorship and connection, and you never know how something's going to shake out. So I'll always give someone some time if they reach out and want to, you know, grab a coffee. So a lot of times, used to, I would do lunches or, coffees and things like that. Sometimes now I'll just have folks stop by the office and we'll chat and give them a little bit of time.
That's always a great move, because I don't have an office. But if I had an office, it's like, just come to me.
Yeah.
And come into my office 20 minutes. I don't have to leave. I don't have to get my car. And then you can, and then they feel cool. Like, I remember going into people's offices. Went to Espo's office first, my first move to town. I sent him an email. He brought me into his office. I remember that feeling of like, holy shit, I'm in Warner. Yeah. I'm in Espo's office. It was like, it's cool to go to the office, I think.
Hey, I've been here over 10 years. I still cold reach out to folks in the industry I don't know and say, hey, you know, I've heard a lot about you. We haven't ever done anything together. Would love to, you know, come hang out or grab coffee. And so I'm on the opposite end of that a lot. And I always just try to honor people's interest and see how it shakes out. I mean, that's how we got connected initially. So
that's the, I remember first time we met, you turned me on to Gary Vee, who at the time was not an obvious turn on. I don't think he was as big as he is now.
He's huge now.
But you were ahead of the trend. You were like, check out, I forget why you recommend him, but I remember checking him out.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, does everybody know about Gary Vee? And I at the time, I don't think they did.
Yeah.
But now they do.
Now they do. And so the next big thing, what is it?
No, I was going to ask you.
Gary Vee.
Well, I was going to ask you, what's the...
Well, you got to love Tim Ferriss. I'm sure you know all...
Well, yeah. I feel like that was... He was Gary Vee before Gary Vee. Don't you think he had his moment?
He's coming back.
Is he doing
now
something?
Now that he's in the Web3 space, he's...
You're
he's
very into
back.
The Web3 space.
I think it's going to be a game changer.
Still, even the fact that it's dipping right now, you still think so?
I do.
Yeah.
Reason being, I think the dip is really... Because stuff was over-marketed and people were treating it as speculative
assets. .com bubble.
Yeah. And so the more practical use of Web3, it's going to take some time to figure out. But even in the music space, just, you know, we have the MMA and songwriter rights are good, trending in a better direction as far as the treatment. But once we can have true utilization of blockchain technology for management of rights, it's an irrefutable record that's stamped on the blockchain. And so when we can figure out that, and there's some companies doing that now, it's going to be massive for the music industry as far as record keeping, payment of royalties, things like that. But it may take another 10 years to do, but folks are working on it now.
It's coming that way.
The future is going to be, you know, your average songwriter, right now, our producer, artist doesn't. If you ask them what their rights were, they don't know. Their attorneys may know if they can recall it over the hundreds of deals that they've done, but they don't know what they do and don't own, and when they're supposed to get payment, and when stuff's going to revert, and things like that. But I think the future of Web3 and the music industry is just like on your iPhone when you have your wallet with, you know, all your money cards. You're also going to have an intellectual property wallet where you can look and see all the songs, your percentage ownership, when you should expect payment, what your unrecouped balances are.
Why wouldn't you have that?
Yeah, when to term notices out. It's all going to be stamped on the blockchain. It's going to be really clean and leave a lot of the ambiguities out. So
yeah.
I know that's in development.
So, okay, so you think Tim Ferriss is going to make a comeback? Not a comeback. He never went anywhere. But you think he's going to do something?
He's in Web3. You know, his is more interesting. You know, I think that all the folks that are getting into Web3 will kind of see another uptick. But
Jake Udell, do you know Jake Udell?
No.
Jake Udell is a big manager in LA, and he had this newsletter that he wrote called about a manager. I think it was called something I would read every day. Everyone read it, like all my friends read it. He was a big manager. I ran into him at a Web3 party 6 months ago. I never met him before. I just went up to him. I said, Jake, like, big fan of the newsletter, like, I'm reading it for years. Like I said something like, what are you working on right now? Like, any artist? He's like, man, I got out of the music industry. I'm just in Web3 now. He's like, I sold the management company. It's like, I'm not even in it. And I was like, oh, you're probably in it for the wrong reasons, Jake. You know, if you weren't in it anymore. But now he's like all in on Web3. The guy's brilliant. He's absolutely brilliant. And he was like, that was more interesting to me. I got out.
Yeah, I mean, I think my fascination is utility with Web3 and crossover integrations between tangible items and Web3, and I think that's kind of the next wave. Even that touches on music, but also other areas as well.
Yeah. I promised our friends here, we've got a little bit of an in-student audience, Lucy,
yes,
and Chris, right?
Yes.
Chris, I said that I was going to put them on the spot and ask them a question, if they had a question for Christian. I don't know if anything came to you guys. Any questions? Lucy wants to be a songwriter. Chris wants to work in the music business. I'm totally putting them on the spot right now. Christian's done more publishing deals than anyone, Lucy. This is your chance right here. How to get a publishing deal. How to get your first job in the music industry. Christian, any advice for someone who's trying to break in?
Absolutely. So, first of all, it's a lot about networking once you're in town and fresh. And I think that that's not always the cold call email, but it's more, you know, you're not going to get to know. I always think of it like it's high school. You don't know the people that were in your high school 10 years before you.
Yeah.
You're not friends with them. You're kind of friends with the people that are a little bit ahead of you. If you say you're a sophomore, you know, the seniors, you know, the juniors, you know, some freshmen, and try to build out your core group of folks that, you feel like you connect with. And then whenever one of you has success, you will all kind of rise together. And that's happened over and over again. Nashville especially is a very crewy place, I would say. And so you have these pockets of songwriters, artists, producers, executives that kind of all do all the same stuff together. And so I think that finding your own crew that you can support one another when you're starting out, but then kind of all succeed together as time goes on, that's the most important thing.
Yeah, how many careers have been made from like Luke Combs? Like Luke Combs, like all those guys, or Morgan Wallen, like all those guys are now like hit songwriters or artists or whatever. Like Luke Combs blows up, and then Ray Fulcher blows up, and then Luke brings Lainey Wilson on tour with him because they all came out together, and there's like a million others, and then 50 Egg becomes a top publishing company because Luke Combs is involved. Like, how many people are around that?
It's always like that, you know, a group that are friends that, you know, you can't substitute hard work. So, you know, if you're a hard worker and you're a good creative, and then you surround yourself with a crew of good folks that are also hard workers, then you will find common success together. And it's fun. You know, I'm representing a couple of like groups of several songwriters and producers that have been doing this since they could barely put food on the table and are coming on success recently. And it's so much fun to watch and, you know, watch their enjoyment of, you know, finally after working so hard for so many years, seeing some of that success is nothing better.
Yeah. That's what it is. So basically, you should just be superficial with the people you hang out with. If you think someone's not going to go very far, don't be friends with them.
Well, if you're there's a spot for everyone.
There's a spot for everyone at the table.
Yeah,
Christian, we've said it all. Have we left anything out?
We'll think of something.
What's been unsaid?
We'll
bring you back for part two.
That's right, dude.
Thank you for coming into the Chase Studio all the way downtown. Made the trip. Came all the way in.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely.
Been a blast.
Christian Barker, everyone, if someone's like listening to this and they're like, oh my god, I got a publishing deal, I gotta connect with Christian, he's gotta represent me, what's the best way to get in touch?
You can hit me up wherever, LinkedIn, my email. My law firm is Shackelford Bowen. It's on Music Row in the BMG building. I'm easy to find at Christian Barker on most of the platforms.
Did you ever get that Tupac tattoo?
I don't have the tattoo yet, but I do have a painting in my office of Tupac.
This guy's a big Tupac
90s
fan.
Hip hop.
Two tattoos going to come one day, or
it
what?
Will.
What's the deal?
It will.
All right, I'm here for it. Let me know.
It's going to
let
happen.
Me know what you got. Christian
we'll get matching
Barker
tattoos.
I'll never get tattoos. I like tattoos on other people. They freak me out on me. I get the thought of getting a tattoo stresses me out. I can't do it. I can't commit to it.
It's good. If I get a Tupac tattoo, will I get a part two?
Sure. Yeah.
Boom.
Yeah. I'll do it.
Next one.
That's good motivation to get it done. Christian Barker, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you. Woo. Did we get it? Oh, we weren't recording. No, I'm kidding.
I don't know if you intro'd him, but...
I typically will do that later. Yeah.
Cool.
Thank you, though.
Dude, fun.
Did it.
We did it.